This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Kalinda Linder, who is a clinical psychologist in private practice. And this episode is part of our commemoration of World Mental Health Day, which is celebrated annually on the 10th of October. Welcome to the show.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me and for shining the spotlight on one of my passions, mental health.
We're very much looking forward to the conversation and to kick off thinking about the mental health dynamic with a little reflection. Could you share your perspective, what you find significant about World Mental Health Day?
Well, you know, I live and practice in South Africa, and so I'm going to give a lot of it from that perspective. So what horrified me when I discovered this a few years ago was that there is only 5% of our health budget spent on mental health. So 95% is on physical health. Absolutely horrifying. And yet, if you look at the statistics, and these are global, 1 in 3 is struggling with their mental health. So in South Africa, that would be 20 million people are those 1 in 3. So for me, Mental Health Day is important because it reminds you to take your mental well-being as seriously as your physical well-being. And for me, I take every opportunity to talk about mental health in terms of awareness and breaking down stigma and sharing knowledge. And one of my other passions is about access to support and to information. So for me, World Mental Health Day is a wonderful day. And in fact, at SADAG, the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, that's my advocacy part, we celebrated for the whole month of October. And in fact, it's the whole year, but especially through October, because we really do need to improve awareness.
Absolutely. Those are shocking statistics. 5% of the health budget goes towards mental health. That's really incredible. And is that comparable to the rest of the world, or are we a little of an anomaly in South Africa?
I would say it's probably comparable. You know, mental health is always the poor cousin that gets left. And if you think about it, your mind animates everything. So I would say it's probably in keeping with, you know, if I look at the groups I belong to, different international therapy groups, all of us are sitting in the same boat where there just aren't resources. So we're the resources. And one of the problems in South Africa, or we could talk more about it later, but there are so few psychologists and so few psychiatrists here. You know, the statistics are horrifying. So there are 3,000 clinical psychologists registered. And remember, we're looking at 20 million who need us. And I don't know how many registered counselors or counseling psychologists, but let's say 5,000 to be generous, and 780 psychiatrists. So this is comparable as well. What I've looked at are numbers in the US, in the UK, and there the numbers are not quite as extreme. So maybe it would be double the amount of resources that we have, but still, that's not very much, is it?
Not at all. I'm not even going to try and do the maths and work out a per populace, because I think it would be embarrassing.
But still, we can see, you know, it's really too little. And that is why when we do shows like these on mental health, you know, people need to start empowering themselves. And for me, knowledge is power. So the more that people can know about their mental well-being, their mental health, the better.
So clearly you are in high demand, and I know that you've been practicing for over 30 years. Tell us about your journey into psychology. What drew you to the profession? And then if you could please lead on to that, on your focus on cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, I would love to do that. Well, you know, after 33 years, actually this year, I'm still passionate. So you'll see why in a moment. So I was thinking, as you were asking, you know, where did it all begin? So part of it, I remember this clearly. I was 11 and we had to do a speech at school on our hobbies, and we didn't have ChatGPT or the internet, so we had to think it up ourselves. And my speech, very seriously, was people watching. And I remember my mom sort of saying, "Are you sure you want to go and do that as your speech?" And I was adamant, "Yes, that's my hobby, that and reading and space and science fiction." And basically, human behavior and the brain, those things have always been my passion. And I thought I might be a neurologist, but when I discovered you had to do dissections in med school, that was the end of that. And I thought I would rather just observe people from the outside or from another angle. So it was that passion. And then with that, I love puzzles and I love problem solving. And I like making neatness out of mess. I am an eldest, perhaps it's that. But I always used to be teased by my sisters that, "Oh, your room is always perfect and everything's in place." And not the papers, they were always controlled chaos. But we seem to be good at, getting order when there's a mess. So I think it was a lot of that. And then also the mind. We explore space, we explore the sea, we explore mountains, but the mind is this amazing, vast thing. And I love learning and exploring. So you can see that this was just a match made in heaven. So I then realized clinical psychology was going to be the thing for me because I really like what we would call hard pathology, psychosis and things like that really attracted me. I was fascinated. So fast forward, I trained at WITS in the 80s. And first we were very much doing psychodynamic training, which is Freud. I wasn't sure that that was quite for me. And then we discovered Jung. And what I loved was dream analysis. His interpretations are unbelievable because I dream vividly every night and I remember. So I did that for my undergrad. And then postgrad, it was just serendipity. A friend of my mother's was actually the head of department at another university. And he mentioned CBT. And I thought, what on earth is that? Long story short, he explained it to me and I jumped ship immediately. So I did all of my postgrad, the honors, the masters, and the doctorate under him. And I'll talk a little bit more about CBT in a sec. And it really wasn't very known. This was in 1990. So there was one CBT therapist in the country and this was him.
Wow.
So I was delighted having met this person. He was a Fulbright scholar, had done his training in the States. And it was such a revelation that there was a different kind of therapy. It didn't just have to be Freudian, because I think I'm not really a good fit for psychoanalytic work. I'm too active and I like to speak and I like to fix and do and collaborate. Maybe it's the oldest in me. So leading on to what CBT is, well, the first thing is that it's evidence-based. I'm a huge, huge skeptic, so I like to see evidence. I will never just do it because someone said so. So I love that there was this marvelous evidence. And if you think from the 1920s onwards, there was Pavlov and Skinner and all of those people with the dogs and Pavlov, and then Freud came in the 40s and Jung came more or less at the same time, the humanists in the 60s. And then from the late 60s, cognitive behavior therapy, where it was the thinking side and the behavioral side, came together. So if I really had to summarize CBT, it's collaborative empiricism. So I've already said the empiricism, which is the research side, and that's very much protocols and skill-based. And I'm showing people the relationship between their thoughts and their feelings and their behaviors. And then this is where the collaborative comes in. So it's very conversational. It really is a conversation, and you leave feeling quite normal, maybe even better, preferably. You don't feel wrecked as you do in traditional therapy. And I quote many, many of my clients saying you feel like a wreck afterwards because you've been crying and talking about all the awful things that ever happened. So when somebody comes to see me with a problem behavior, I won't go and analyze and look for some deep, dark reason. There isn't necessarily that. Of course, we all have a past. It brings us here, and we do look at that. But then let's say take procrastination. A lot of people have that problem. So you're sitting here and you're procrastinating. So if somebody were more old school, they might delve into, well, what were your relationships like with your parents, and what happened, when there were demands or expectations, and that could take 2 to 5 years. So with CBT, we don't do that. We'll send them off to go and do a behavioral analysis, some homework, and then that we would explain that procrastination is an avoidance behavior, and that is to do with your thoughts and your feelings. So what is going on there? So we don't do too much on the behavior in the beginning, and we don't really mind the trigger because we'll be triggered no matter what. We really bring the emphasis into what are you telling yourself? Are you saying it's too much, I can't do it, I'm overwhelmed? And then you get the feeling of overwhelmed. Are you a perfectionist? So you're thinking, I have to do it perfectly. And then if I can't, it'll be a mess. And of course, you're going to have an overwhelm. So you can see that relationship. And the difference is that we work with the client. So everything I just told you, we would tell them. And it'll be like a tennis match, and we'll collaborate back and forth. And then we'll look at, well, what could have been your core beliefs that you learned when you were young? And then we work in the here and now with the core beliefs. So I could go on all day about CBT, but I think that's pretty much a summary. It's the relationship between thoughts and feelings and behaviors. And it's very much collaborative in the here and now and empirically based. So we train people to not need therapy, which I think is fabulous. Why not? If you've got the skills and you can share them, why not?
Thank you so much for that overview. It really seems to be in the here and now, and that you have these productive outputs. Because if you think about movie scenarios, people are forever seeing their therapists. And no wonder if you've got an issue like procrastination, it's taking you 2 years to unpack it, that when you've got the next issue, that you're going to spend that same sort of extensive time and not overcome anything. So I also think what's important is that people need to be aware of the different types of I don't know, would it be a mode,
Different modalities,
the modalities that therapists are practicing, and to see what works for them.
Exactly. And look, CBT is the only evidence-based therapy, and I'm not saying there isn't a place for any other therapy. Some people like logo therapy, which is about meaning, when horrible things have happened. So they might prefer that approach. Some people prefer the more humanist, where they actually don't have anybody, where they can go and vent and talk and, each to their own. And then others really want to delve, and those ones go into the more psychodynamic or the Jungian. And I think you've got to look at your context. So for things like anxiety, depression, bipolar, sleep disorders, stress, burnout, that kind of thing, CBT is definitely proven to be more effective. So, I feel if somebody comes in with panic, for example, it doesn't really help to say, oh, you poor thing, and be very nice to them week after week after week. Oh, you poor thing, how many panic attacks did you have? That must have been so awful. But I don't really think that's so valuable after a period of time. And then the psychodynamic person wouldn't look at the panic. They would just park it because that's a symptom. And they would really go back into your childhood. So you'd have to suffer with the panic for however many years. Whereas CBT would be about, okay, this is what's happening in your brain. We know this from the 1960s onwards. There are a lot of research papers and things, and there are some techniques, and this is how you do it. And once you've got the symptom under control, you would look at, well, what was it that caused the stress? And then you would work with it at that deeper level. So again, as you say, each to their own. But certainly for anxiety, depression, that whole list I gave you, CBT really is more appropriate. So I feel people need to know that. There's no need to suffer. Life is hard enough. So if something can help you, why wouldn't you do it if you knew it existed?
Why not indeed? You mentioned anxiety as one area, and I know that in your practice you've been going for 33 years, celebrating this year, which is a massive, massive milestone. Can you tell us perhaps some of the typical psychological or emotional challenges that women face in general?
When I think about being a woman, I often think about puberty. That puberty for girls can be catastrophic. I remember that for me. I was a runner, long distance runner, and then puberty happened, and these are women listening, I got these horribly huge boobs, and I went from just a flat, long, skinny child to double D's. So that was the end of my career. My skin went crazy. It was horrendous. And maybe I'm being subjective, but if you look across the board, what happens in a girl's body at puberty, there's so much going on. And I'm not saying boys have an easy time because their brains are also going through this, but physically, they're actually having a lot of fun. Testosterone, it sounds like a lot of fun. They don't have periods, et cetera, et cetera. They're in their prime, they can build muscle. We're kind of growing in places we didn't know we had.
And
So,
disproportionately.
yes, exactly. So, from the get-go, I think it's challenging, what goes on with women's bodies, and think about, pregnancy. Well, the guy has a little part of it, and then you kind of had the next 9 months and possibly after, and then menopause, So I think women have an interesting time of it. Having said that, I would still rather be a woman, I think. Women's brains are different than men's brains. And I did genetics undergrad. So one of my interests is in looking at those differences. And I'm generalizing here, but men's brains, in all the studies where they've looked at how men process, can spotlight. So men can spotlight in on something and quite happily forget everything else. Now, women use double the serotonin because we spotlight and then floodlight, no matter what this thing is. So we're on all the time. And so I think it is interesting, being a woman in the world, and especially a modern woman. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that, especially my tribe, the modern working mother. This is a new phenomenon, or a relatively new phenomena. So I think that there's some interesting challenges for that particular population.
Tell
But
us
shall I get
more.
into that?
Yes, please tell us more, because it is a reality. This is a cohort. We're working women, and these are challenges that people experience. But because of us maybe being one of the newest type of generations in the market, we don't have a precedence that's been set that we could leverage off of. So please tell us more.
That's exactly it. If I look around, I'm in my 50s, but I think for women in their 40s and 50s, our mothers didn't necessarily have careers, or certainly that was an anomaly. So for many of us, we do have careers. So if we do have a partner and we do have children, they come after the career mostly. So your career is your first child and or your first love. You can hear I speak about my psychology career. My twins are 22 and I love them and they're wonderful. Husband the same. But this is my child. My first child is 33 now. So I think that's the challenge, that we don't really have role models for how to juggle all of these things. So should we have a child, we don't really know quite, how do we juggle this? Because now we have to neglect our first child. And especially if you've done a lot of studies towards that, you've really invested. So I think that's one of the big challenges. And what I find with working mothers is some women try to be men, and then they have a nanny or childcare, and they hardly see the children, perhaps on the weekend. But it doesn't really work when you have estrogen for all of us. For some women, it does, but for many of us, it doesn't. And then at the other end, I find a lot of judgment. I find judgment in all places. So I find the women who have embraced, well, I'm going to be like a man and somebody else will raise the children, they set meetings at 5 o'clock, not too fussed about where you might be at home doing dinner. And then at the other end are the women in my generation and younger who don't want to have a career. And I never forget this. My children, when they were little at school, they must have been in grade three. And one of the moms said to me, "I'm so sorry you have to work." And I'm hardly ever speechless, but that day I was, because I thought, "What on earth are you talking about?" So then we get the judgment. Oh, she works. Oh, so that was very challenging. What am I? Because we don't have role models for that. So I eventually came up with something called the Voldemort woman. So if we go back to Harry Potter, Voldemort, he who should not be named. Well, we don't have a name, so I'm calling us the Voldemorts. So we work and we have careers that we love, and we want to be mothers, and we want to invest in our marriage as well, and we want to do a little bit on our health and do the odd exercise or meditation. And that's tricky as anything, because we have no role models for that. And if you're a single mom or a married single, as I say sometimes, or you don't have resources, you don't have the finances, that's another challenge. So what do you do? So there are many permutations here of how do you work with this as a modern working mother?
So two things that I want to ask you here, and we don't lose track. One is, I think there's this aspect of stereotypes. So we kind of grow up with these perceptions of how and who women should be and what they should do. And I remember having a vivid conversation with Terry Folkvane, who was the CEO of Primedia at the time. And she said that her and her husband had agreed that because of the way her career was going, she was flying, everything was moving ahead, that they were going to kind of swap roles, that she was foremost with the career and he was going to look after the family. And she said that there was so much conflict, not between them, but between the rest of the world, like that people had seen him as being kind of emasculated, was a demasculated because of the role that he was doing. And she just said, you have all of these other challenges that you try and manage around you, which have got nothing to do with those people, but you have to navigate it. And then the second piece is you are a working mom. Your first child is your profession. And when we were chatting offline, some of the reasons for you choosing psychology were actually related to thinking about your life, your working life. It wasn't just about an interest in a field that you were passionate about. So if you could expand on that too, please.
Lovely, lovely. Well, if I look at the stereotypes, yes, there seems to be judgment all over the place. And I think exactly what she was describing, it happens much more than you think. And if we look at the world at the moment, men are kind of the devil. So I think women are getting more opportunities anyway, and not across the board. And I know some people will absolutely vehemently disagree in the glass ceiling, but I don't know that that's necessarily always true. So for me, it's about the division of labor. Have you got an agreement as to who does what and who does it better than the other? So as long as the couple has that agreement between them. So there's this movement with young girls in their early 20s, the tradwife kind of movement. And at the other end is, men are terrible. And in both of these extremes, well, if you are with a partner who is kind of traditional and you're traditional, okay, that can work. You've got your division of labor. And if you're in a setup where it's not traditional, that can also work because you've got your division of labor. So for me, that's the key thing. It's all about agreements. So that's on that side of things. Because the judgment is so silly. And just a little segue, me and stigma and mental health, I have to put this in here. If we think about nature, if there were a catch, and if we're looking at another cat or a dog or a mouse or a monkey or something extreme like that, the cat would look at friend, foe, food, mate. It would just discriminate that this is what that is, but it wouldn't have a layer of judgment. So if we as women could do the same thing, that you're a stay-home mom, you're a working mom, you're a this mom, you're a that mom, okay, or you're a this partner or you're a that partner, okay. So discriminate that is different to me, but stop it there. Why judge it? Nature's not doing that. Never. So it's humans with our big frontal lobes doing all of this silly stuff. So that's my little rant on the stigma of things. And it's the same with mental health. Someone is depressed, okay. Or someone is anxious, okay. Well, let's not judge it. Let's just see it as that. You don't judge someone for being diabetic. Maybe one does because of, it's a lifestyle disease type 2. But you know what I'm saying? We judge all the time, and it's so unnecessary. So I think we could do a whole show on that. So I'll move to your second point. Yes, that my mom was a very inspiring woman. I'll talk more about her later. But she just opened my mind to all the possibilities. And as a young girl, I looked around and I'm not sure where this came from, but I wanted to have autonomy. I wanted to have options. And I'm hoping that if there are people listening who are still early on in their careers or relationships, I didn't necessarily want children, actually, until I was in my early 30s, that I wanted the option that if I did, I would be able to have a career and be autonomous, make my own money if needs be. Things can happen. And also be able to choose my hours. And I spent 10 years before I had the children really working hard to establish myself. And again, I didn't know that I wanted children until about a year before that. So, 9 years were just full throttle career, but always in the back of my head that I want to give myself options. And I think that's the important thing. We need to look at that when we're younger. I mean, you could say, want to be more traditional, and then something happens to the man, and then you don't know. Maybe you don't, he didn't have a policy, or something happens and you don't get it, and then what? And maybe you have a career and, you're thinking, oh, I never want children, so I don't have to worry about autonomy and flexibility. And then in your 30s, the clock hits. So always try and be as aware as possible of how can I make options for myself. For me, that would be, it's quite a helpful thing. And my mom actually taught me that. She wasn't in a career, she did work, but she wasn't in the kind of career I am. But somehow she was very wise and she just gave me these options in my mind. And I never forgot that. So for me, I love this career, but also there was definitely a good reason that, yes, I want to have all the options available to me.
That's such an important point that you've articulated. And I think as well, when people are younger, that they can be a little short-sighted about things. And we live in a world where everything is on demand and we have instant gratification. We don't like waiting, but there are things which may take a little time, like going out and getting your degree, that it's not instant, but it stands you instead for the future for opening those
Yes.
options.
I'm thinking of my daughter in this instance. She's 22 and she has a number of medical conditions, and a lot of her treatments will need to be in the US. And I'd like to think I had something to do with it, but she holds the lineage, I suppose, of the strong woman. And she's studying agriculture. She loves animals and she loves plants and she can grow anything. And she thought, well, she wanted to do horticulture, but agriculture was a more solid choice because it opened up the world to her. So she already, at a young age, made that decision that I need to do this. I need to be able to work anywhere. I need to be able to earn because my mother can't pay for my medical bills forever. And I need to be able to get to another country where I can get the treatments I need. And I mean, I was flabbergasted when she told me. I thought, wow. I mean, she was 18 when she made those decisions. Thought, my work here is done. So, I really think we need to think long term. It's not just about the career satisfaction or having a calling. We need to be practical in the world as well. That is where we find ourselves. It may change in a number of years from now, but this is where we find ourselves for the foreseeable future. We have to, if we look at Maslow, the hierarchy of needs, we can't be self-actualizing only. That the needs at the bottom are the basic needs for security or safety, being able to feed yourself, etc. And I think often we want to go straight to the self-actualization. Oh, this will be calling, it'll be so wonderful, everything will be lovely. And that isn't really where it's at. So if we can, we need to keep both in mind, practical and that idealized.
You are obviously a fantastic
These are all my
resource.
passions. I could talk about each of these. Well, I'd like to think that. I'll take the compliment. I'm learning to receive in my 50s, so thank you.
But also to your daughter. And the piece that I'm wanting to make here is that if people are not as fortunate, where do they go? Is it mentors? Is it reading material? Because those are hard elements to lock in and help you for life in the future that you don't necessarily know where it's going to go.
Well, I did a book called Get the Balance Right, which is for working mothers. And this was really for any working mother. And there are resources like that around. So I think, we live in the age of information. And perhaps the problem is there are too many. So I would say find somebody who could be a mentor in a work context, or even I mentor a lot of students. I'm through my work at SADAG, and I'm very happy to do it. People who are undergrad, and is this really the career for them? And I let them shadow me at the practice to an extent. And I'm happy to mentor. And there are a lot of women who want to give back, especially when you're further in your career. I mean, you're doing that now. This whole initiative is really all about giving back, where you're getting experienced people to come and give advice so that people who are younger and starting in the world can actually listen and, oh, that resonates, that resonates. So I would say we need to be proactive. My advice would be to go around, look for a mentor, see where you can find the information, and also be very, very clear about it must be resonant. So even if somebody's famous or everybody else goes to them or everybody else is doing what they say, if it doesn't resonate, you will know in your heart of hearts, this isn't me. And I think that's the key thing. You've got to find somebody where the fit feels like that's an older me. And there are so many of us who are the older me's who are very happy to mentor the younger me's. So I get associates at the practice every 5, 6 years, and then I choose people who I can mentor and who will outgrow me. And then off they go, and I'm not sad because then the next crop come. And I think there are many of us. I mean, I'm sure you're exactly the same, very happy to mentor younger people. So look for us, young ladies. We are here.
I love that expression of looking for an older you.
Yes,
Then
exactly.
you've got a vision of the direction that you could be going in. And as you said earlier, it's not about closing the options because options can change, but it's about looking for someone who resonates with you to move forward.
Yes.
Dr. Linda, our time is rapidly running out. So, as we come towards the end of the show, one question I ask all my guests is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. So, please share a few with us.
Oh, there are so many. I think what helped was that I knew what my passion was from when I was quite young. And we didn't grow up with many material resources, but my mother was a huge figure in my life. And I think, she modeled. She wasn't an educated person. No one educated girls in those days. But she had such wisdom and she kept me grounded. So I think that was part of it, so that I didn't go off into this flight in my head. And I think knowing your direction, so I always had a direction, and she really reinforced education that was something, you can never be taken away from you. So all of us had to do a degree. We all had student loans and things, but all of us had to have a degree because you will have to have something. I don't care what it is. And then I guess most things that can happen to a person have happened to me. And I say this with gratitude. I'll just mention some of them. Let's just say I had a very colorful father, so that by the time I got to learning about mental pathology, well, I'd lived it. So let's leave it at that because that's another whole discussion. So him being, like he was, actually was painful in many ways, but we moved a lot and he was, not very stable. But I became very comfortable, so nothing scares me and nothing phases me at work. So, I look back and I think, well, okay. When I was young, I was 7 when I got glasses and I was teased mercilessly, and they weren't beautiful ones like nowadays. And I was a long, skinny child. So my nickname, I was also a nerd, was Skinny Malinky Four Eyes Nerd. Quite a mouthful. And we moved schools a lot because of my father. So, oh no, I'm going to have a new crop of people teasing me. It wasn't nice. However, when grown-ups sit in my office now and say, I'm so embarrassed that I still feel like this about this thing that happened in the past, I normally bring out the skinny Malinky story for us and they start laughing. And you see, that I mean, it took me until COVID to start wearing my glasses full time. Because I had this thing about my glasses all these years. And I normalized. So I've had many things. And, I had a few health scares and ovarian cancer at one point and all of that. But I'm not a cancer survivor. There was just a cancer phase in my life. And now I am me. So wonderful, terrible, depends how you look at it. So I think I very much believe make meaning out of what's happening. And I've had a rich and colorful life. With so many important people, so many mentors. No woman, I couldn't find any. My mom was my mentor, I guess that way. But in my career, I had one female mentor, Zane Wilson, who started SADAG, shows you what can be done. And then male mentors who were like older brothers, which was very, very helpful. And then finally, I have to mention this highlight of my career was meeting Dr. David Barlow. So he is our Freud, basically. Took myself off to a conference in the States in the 90s and then for a few years after that. And I don't remember what he said to me. And I think he was very gracious because I was this wide-eyed person. Here I was in the same room as the man who created the bulk of what I do. And he loves South Africans because one of his early teachers was Joseph Welpy, who's from here. And that was just a highlight, thinking, little me. Little skinny malinky four eyes nerd. Here I am in the office of Dr. David Barlow, who is our Freud. Well done, you. And I cherish that memory. It's absolutely the highlight. And I saw him again many times after that. But that moment, sitting in the office thinking, okay, this can be done. You got here. You did this yourself. You got here. So, I really feel. It depends how we look at events. And you really can spin some hidden gifts out of any negative thing. And yeah, celebrate your wins. When you get there, actually celebrate. I got here. Again, I could go on. I'm very passionate about life. So you can imagine I could tell you many stories, but I think I'll leave it at that.
But thank you for sharing those experiences. They're very special, but also the view of how you can choose to take a different perspective, that there are many, many sides to the same thing, but it's the
Exactly.
perspective that you take. And as we wrap up, please use this platform to share a few words of wisdom or inspiration that you'd like to pass on to girls and women who are listening to us.
Maya Angelou, one of her quotes, as I'm thinking, actually, there are two. The one is by Alvin Toffler. He's a futurist, and he said this long ago. He said, the real illiterate of the 21st century. Will not be those who can't read or write, but it will be those who can't learn, unlearn, relearn. So I say this to everybody, and especially to women. We've learned many things about what it is to be a woman and what's right and wrong. And that's nonsense. We can unlearn and relearn. So go with what resonates with you. That's number one. And then perhaps one of my favorites, Maya Angelou. She was just unbelievable. And she says, you have two hands, one for helping others and one for helping yourself. So please, please always remember that your self-care and what you receive needs to be in balance with what you give out. So that for me would be my wish that women would just keep that in their minds.
Thank you so much. Very powerful, colorful statements that everyone should be able to take on board. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
And you, and I'm sure we could have gone on for many hours, so we'll have to do this again. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and today we've been talking to Dr. Kalinda Linder, who is a clinical psychologist in private practice.
Thank you.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.